Welcome to my podcast, Living with Ovarian Cancer. My name is Diane Evans-Wood and I'm one of many women who are living with ovarian cancer. I want to give women like me a voice to share with you what it's like to live with ovarian cancer. We will cover a whole range of aspects related to diagnosis, treatment, recurrence and, well, just about everything in between. I hope you find our honest, candid, but often humorous conversations not only useful, but also uplifting. So without further ado, settle down and listen to my conversation today. Hello everyone, thank you for being here with us for yet another episode. So before I introduce my next guest, please could I ask you to subscribe to the show and leave a rating after you've listened. It really does help the show to become more visible for people to find on the podcast search platforms. So today I'm very honoured to be talking to Jo Fiella. Now, Jo and I have been in constant communication to try and arrange to record this episode, but as cancer does and as technology does, things got in the way on several of occasions. So whether that was Jo or myself having to rearrange. So today I'm very pleased to have her here with me. She's got such an amazing, inspiring story to tell, very interesting. So I hope you enjoy our episode today. So welcome, Jo. It's so good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. That's lovely to speak to you. Yeah.
Oh, can you tell me more about who you are, where you live, the job you do or did, what you love to do, pets, hobbies, all that sort of thing, just so we can get to know you a bit?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I was born in Stockport in 1951 and an only child, the first one ever to go to grammar school. I went to university, became a secondary teacher of French and German in a bilingual school, Welsh and English, in Mid Wales, which I loved, but was able to take early retirement at 55, which I'm very glad I did. Oh. I live with my husband in a beautiful hilly area of northwest Shropshire, 2 miles outside a market town, and really enjoy life here, keeping as busy as I can. On retirement, I taught English as a foreign language to foreigners who came and stayed in my home. I volunteered for the National Trust, the local hospice, played badminton, tennis, did B&B. We live on a national walking trail. Yeah, well, and only recently took in a Ukrainian family, a 30-year-old couple with a 16-month-old daughter, which I really enjoyed.
Oh, that's so lovely. Oh. But we're here to talk today then about, well, ovarian cancer. And I'm just wondering, what was it that led you to think that something was wrong? Can you remember back and tell me what your symptoms were and really what your story is with ovarian cancer in your own words?
Well, really, I wasn't aware of the connection even between ovarian cancer and breast cancer when I got this. And with hindsight, there's a lot that I could have researched, because my mother was the youngest of 6 children, 5 of whom were female. And my first aunt was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 61. Mm. My mother also developed breast cancer at the age of 59. This is in 1978. Mm-hmm. I was relieved to find that 8 years later, the blood test CA125 was made available and genetic testing was developed. I wanted the test straight away, filled in forms, but the local authority declined my attempt, as they were only testing patients whose relatives had contracted cancer in their early 30s and 40s. So I decided then, at my birthday, to have a well woman test involving a CA125, and I knew it was a constant 12 for 30 years. Mm. In fact, my GP said he never saw me except for this annual MOT. At the age of 16, my GP told me I had the same chance as the general public of getting cancer. So 6 years later, in 2017, I'd been needing to urinate quickly for a month and thought it was, oh yeah, it's my age. I'm 66 now, kind of lady time. Mm-hmm. And I went to my GP, first of all, in February 2017 and repeatedly went back until I was told I needed a colonoscopy. They were suspecting diverticulitis. By this time, I was having pains, which felt like the old period pains of the previous 17 years. Mm. I thought it was a gynecological problem, but no blood tests or stool tests were offered even. Mm. If only I'd had the knowledge then and could have advocated for myself.
Oh, Joe.
So in the May, being in constant pain, I decided to pay for a private ultrasound scan, where a 10 centimetre simple cyst was found on my left ovary. Mm-hmm. I decided I was in so much pain, and it was very lucky, that I needed to have a private operation ASAP. And within 5 days, I had the operation. To be told, there were no visible signs of cancer, they had only removed my ovaries and fallopian tubes. 4 weeks later, after the biopsy, I was given the news that the oncologist sent it to 3 labs and he couldn't believe that there was 0.5 millimetre of cancer present. So I was staged 1A borderline. He said, if I had to have cancer, it was the best thing, best stage obviously to have.
Yeah, like there's the best cancer to have.
Whatever that is, yes. So I then had to have a hysterectomy and my omentum removed. And again, the same result. No visible signs of cancer. I didn't believe him this time when he said that. But of course, when the biopsy was reported, there was one area of 0.5 millimetre in each of the uterus and omentum. I was now staged at 3A.
Right.
I wasn't given a CT. I was told it wouldn't show up. And when I inquired about genetic testing, I was told I couldn't have it done again. This was over the border in Wales. I needed this knowledge. I knew by this point I'd done lots of research. I needed it for my further treatment and also the fact that I've got 3 daughters.
Yeah.
So my GP surgery admitted they had let me down 8 times. In fact, it was 14 times overall when secretarial issues were included.
Yeah.
They closed the surgery, had a morning where my case was discussed, and I hope that it helps ladies in my area. But I asked my GP to refer me to the Christie Hospital.
Yeah.
After chemo, I had one frontline was carbotaxol.
Yeah.
I was not very happy with the oncologist that I saw there, who would say one thing one time I met her and the opposite the following time. So the GP surgery wrote a letter and said that they would support my application to go to the Christie, which is about 70 miles away from home. But I felt, having been let down so many times in a local area, I needed to go to a hospital with
it was worth a lot that of expertise.
Yeah. So I was accepted there in January 2018, given a CT straight away, and undertook genetic testing. They couldn't understand why I'd not been allowed to have these 2 things. And it came as no surprise that I have the BRCA2 faulty gene. In fact, in the interim, I spoke to a relative who told me that one of my other aunts had died of tummy problems when I was very young, which we now presume was ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
I'd only been aware that that my mother and another aunt had had breast cancer. If I'd have known about this ovarian cancer link, which I presume was the other aunt, then I'd have gone and actually mentioned ovarian cancer rather than I thought it was gynecological problems.
Yeah.
Because it just felt like the period pains.
Do you think you would have been more proactive and had surgery if you'd known that you were BRCA positive? Do you think you'd have had surgery prophylactically?
Absolutely. There's my daughters say that when they were living with me, I constantly was talking about breast cancer, and it was in my mind for so many years that, yes, I mean, if I'd have had the test and it had been negative, I'd have celebrated, but I was so convinced
you
in my
knew own mind. It, didn't
and
you?
That was one of the reasons why I left teaching, surprisingly enough. I loved teaching and I didn't know how I was going to survive without it, but I thought I'd spent so many years giving myself to other people and I was convinced that I would be I would contract cancer like my relations.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, really, but
well, no, not really. I think intuitively, and also I think, you know, from a knowledge point of view as well, you knew there was every chance that you were going to develop this type of cancer. I think your gut feeling was that you were going to.
Yeah, but you know, why didn't I research into it and find out that there was, you know, this link with ovarian cancer? I was not aware of that, and I'm a reasonably intelligent person. I didn't know anything about it, and I took the GP's word as gospel. I never ever said anything against them or questioned them. No. I told them how I felt it was, and they totally disregarded it, even though they knew that I'd been on my notes.
Yeah.
It was quite a large practice, so I never was ever able to see the same doctor. It wasn't consistent.
No continuity, is there?
That's right. Yeah.
I don't think it's, I think the important thing that it's not your fault. You're not to reproach yourself for not knowing, because there is more knowledge about it these days. I think there are more people out there trying to raise awareness, but also you do put your faith in your doctors.
Yeah.
You do tell them what you think, and if they say no this, and they do tests or whatever, you know, in their experience, even they say no, we really truly don't think this is anything to worry about, then you feel real you would have felt reassured by that, though.
That's
Jen,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I mean, I've learned so much from since contracting ovarian cancer and becoming aware of the charities and the website Ovarian Cancer UK. So much. And now I like to give people not any medical advice, but, you know, you're not causing a fuss. Please, if you're worried, go and mention that it's ovarian, you think it's ovarian cancer. And one of the ladies on the site, I won't mention her name, says that if you ask for a CA125 or an ultrasound scan and they say no, then make sure that it's written down in your notes. You see, I would never have dreamt of doing that. I wasn't aware of the not only just asking for something, telling a doctor more or less his or her job. And then certainly I would never have said before and write it down in the notes that you've said no.
Yeah.
I think that's very important, because perhaps it's my age, I don't know, but I've got this, perhaps younger people aren't quite as old fashioned as perhaps I am, thinking that doctors are the be all and end all of everything. But now I question absolutely everything.
Yeah, you've got a vested interest in your body, because it's your life. And I think that more and more, I think that doctors now expect to be challenged. And I think that it's more about discussion and negotiating with them. What is the right thing for you?
That's right.
And not all doctors are that way yet.
Yes.
But
yeah.
More and more, I think that doctors are becoming a lot more amenable to the suggestions that patients make, and will sort of, if we're worried about something, they will do a test. I know in my own situation, if I'm really worried about pain or symptoms, my oncologist will say, well, what would you like me to do? And I'll say, well, I think I would really like to have a CT. I haven't had one for a while. And she'll do it. So they're much more amenable with this discussion. It's a two-way process more now these days, I think. As I say, not with all doctors yet, though. Yeah.
I think that's one of the most important things, is to find an oncologist that you have trust and faith in, yeah, and are able to discuss. And that is what I have found at the Christie, which, mm-hmm, I didn't find in my local hospital. Not only did she, as I say one thing one time and then changed her mind the other, she was the god and wouldn't listen to anything that I said. And yes, you need some kind of relationship where you can discuss things, what is best for yourself. I believe that. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to your story, because I interrupted you.
It's okay.
I thought that was important for us to discuss. Yeah. But let's go back to the story where you went to the Christie, sorry, and you've had your BRCA test, haven't you, and found out, yeah, that you're positive. So what happened after that?
Well, it took quite a while for me to get back to normal after the carbotaxol. The actual chemo itself, I suffered a bit of fatigue after the fourth line, but I was worse afterwards. And it wasn't a feeling of being set free from chemo like a lot of people. I really had awful times where I was lying down at home in terrible pain, digestive pain. And that went on for about 6 to 8 weeks. But what happened then? I had a good response to the chemo. By the way, I was 21, CA 25 of 21. I'd known that it had been a constant for 30 years, and it went down to 12, and there were no signs of cancer. But in April of that year, NICE allowed ladies after frontline with the BRCA faulty gene to be put on a PARP inhibitor, but only within 6 to 8 weeks of finishing chemo. I was 16 weeks after frontline and couldn't have been given it, which at the time I was very upset about.
Yeah.
However, it's worked in my favour. I mean, I knew all the chances of it recurring, and you know, particularly within the first 2 years. I feel very lucky now to think that I was NED, no evidence of disease, for 4 years without the PARP.
Yeah.
And after 2 years, I suggested I had a double mastectomy. I wasn't allowed to have it before then. I had asked at the Christie when I was NED, and they said, no, you wait until 2 years and then we'll discuss it. So, more or less to the date, I write these things down. They're very important to me. And it was arranged. Just as COVID took over, I was given a date. Wow. And I discussed it with my daughter in Cornwall, and she said, Mum, it's a new thing, COVID. They don't know how to treat. They don't know how it's being contracted and things like that. So she said, living where you do, it's the worst thing if you have a double mastectomy and you're lying at home in the middle of the countryside with COVID. You get a lot of pain if you're coughing and all that kind of thing. So I decided to cancel the operation. And it was it was still in my mind. You know, this is since 1986. It was in my mind, and now it's COVID that's
I've got the all clear and COVID comes in the way. However, I went back to playing badminton, being very active. I took a medically supervised course, which you can get through your doctor at a local leisure centre to keep myself as fit as I could until COVID came along. So I was Ned until July 2021. And just before that, I had organised my double mastectomy.
Yeah.
And I went for my pre-op and the breast surgeon said all my bloods were fine. And I asked specifically about my CA125. I'd arranged it with the Christie and the surgeon that they should give me a CA125, which they wouldn't normally for a preventative double mastectomy. And he said, oh, it's fine. I said, no, what is the number, please? And he said, 32. It's under 35. I said, no, it's gone from 20 to 32. So I went into that double mastectomy thinking, oh, my God, I think I've got ovarian cancer back again. It's not been sorted. So anyway, after that, I got in touch with the oncologist at the Christie. I had a CT scan. Oh, it was an awful phone call. It showed widespread gains and grains of cancer in my abdomen. Mm-hmm. Luckily, none had gone out of the abdomen.
Yeah.
And the good thing, he said, were they were all on the surface of some of my vital organs, not in it. Yeah. So the liver, stomach and colon.
Yeah.
So after my double mastectomy in the July, I started chemo in the September. And this is Professor Jason. I mentioned his name. He's a wonderful man at
I've heard of this.
Yeah. I had a phone call from him and he said, I'm not too bothered about it. I said, I am bothered about it. Yeah. Now this was before the CT scan. Yeah. And it was actually me who said, I do need a CT scan.
Yeah.
Anyway, he asked me, What did you have the first time round? So I said, carbotaxol. He said, how were you? I said, well, I was fine having the chemo. But it was afterwards I really had a bad time for many, many months.
Flat, didn't it? Yeah.
Not just fatigue, but pains and whatever.
Yeah.
So he said, well, we could try carbocalix. And I said, oh, yes, I've read about that. The Red Devil. And he said, yes, but it's not necessarily going to happen to you just because it happens with some people. So I started that, my first recurrence last September 2021. And that finished this year in February. And I've got to say, for me, it had far fewer side effects. So much easier for me than frontline. I felt really lucky. And again, I had a complete response to this chemo. It was brilliant. And I signed up for the ICON 9 trial.
Yes.
But as per usual, something had cropped up. I'd had bad teeth problems with chemo. I'd had two teeth break off during the, I think it was 5 months I did it, September through to February. Yeah.
Yeah.
I needed to get them fixed within a very small window, which I did, following guidance from the oncologist. Within a window of 1 week, I had one tooth extracted and the other one with a root canal right next to each other, 2 days running. My goodness me, it was a horrible experience.
Oh, I can imagine. Oh, no. Oh.
So what happened was that the last one on the Wednesday and on the Friday, I didn't feel well. I took my temperature and it was sky high. So I think it was something like 37.9.
Right.
And so I phoned up the Christie knowing they'd say what they'd say, but I just wanted to, she said, oh, you should have gone at 37.5, I think it was.
Yeah.
So I went to the local hospital and ended up having an infection.
Yeah.
I met a doctor there. I took her name down. I wasn't very happy with what she said. She gave me an antibiotic. She said, you don't need intravenous treatment. But the even I know that amoxicillin is a fairly low antibiotic. It isn't a very hard one. Anyway, and she gave it me for 5 days. And she said, if you take these after 5 tablets, take your temperature again, and you will find it's come way down. Well, after 5 tablets, it was even higher.
Yeah.
So at 11:30 on the Saturday night at night time, my husband took me back to the A&E 22 miles away, and I spoke to a doctor there who couldn't believe the treatment I'd been given. And the amount of time, it should not have been a five-day, it should have been a 7-day treatment. And he said, that's far too weak. You need a strong antibiotic. So, and he asked me the name. I said, oh, yes, I took the lady's name down. I wouldn't normally have done that in the past, but, you know, everything now is. So he said, I'll have a word with her. So that doesn't instill much faith in it, too much trust.
No, there should be a protocol for chemotherapy patients in every hospital, so that they know that if you go in with a high temperature, 35 for an hour or more, then 37.5, I should say, and then actually then there should be a protocol that kicks in where you'll have intravenous antibiotics followed up by oral antibiotics.
Yes,
that's what should happen.
Yeah, anyway, I was on a double amount of antibiotics, which knocked me back considerably. And it's very strange because my breathing was at its worst when I had this, and I began to wonder whether I'd not got COVID. I tested myself for COVID and it came out negative. But unfortunately, what it did do, those two sets of antibiotics I was on made my bloods not compatible for the trial.
Oh.
So having come out with a complete response, signed all the forms, had the tooth, teeth done, infections, antibiotics, couldn't go on the trial. Again, I was really quite upset.
Yeah,
but what they have done was given me a PARP inhibitor, Lynparza, which I would have had on the trial anyway, but there was a 50-50% chance of being randomly selected to take on another new drug. I'm not going to say it just in case I get it wrong. But and luckily, I've been on that since the end of March now. And I was told straight away, having the faulty gene, that it should give me 2 to 3 years. It should keep me stable for 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I've not asked and what happens after then, but I presume it depends on if and when where the cancer comes back as to they decide then.
Yeah, things change, don't they? Think new things, new developments come along. So although you might be wondering, well, what next? Then by then there will be other things that are coming along. There are new drugs all the time coming along for ovarian cancer.
Yeah. So my first CT after the 3 months of taking Lynparza showed no evidence of disease. So that was, he said he was delighted.
Excellent.
Give me that news.
Yeah.
I have no side effects. And for me, it's given me back my life.
Yeah.
So it's really good. But I don't feel that I've got the fitness. And of course, I'm 5 or 6 years older than I was before, 5 years older, to go back. People keep asking me, when am I coming back to badminton and tennis and things like that? But I don't know whether I'll perhaps go and stand on the court one day. But that's going inside badminton, actually. I could. Yeah. What I am doing at the moment, actually, I've got involved with a cycling hub
in
the local town, a social group for people. I mean, I can cycle, and I just don't like cycling on my own on lanes around here. And you know, that will give me a little bit of fitness back. But I do try to walk every day anyway.
Yeah, I know you do your best to keep fit, don't you, Jo?
Yeah.
Is it COVID that puts you off meeting people indoors?
Yeah.
I know
I'm one of these people even with 6 injections, I know it seems ridiculous, but my daughter, who, as I say, is in the medical profession, says, Mum, everybody's going to get it sometime. But I
understand you, because I'm kind of in the same space as you, in the fact that I keep thinking, although I've had all the, you know, I've had all my COVID jabs as put forward to me, you know, I've accepted everything, I've done all the isolating and all the rest of it. So when the whole world then goes back to normal virtually without their masks and everything, they're healthy and they'll probably get over COVID really quite quickly. Whereas I feel that I haven't had all those treatments and gone through everything, you know, to keep me going, to be living with the cancer that I've got, to be then carted off in a coffin with COVID.
That's it. And we can't say if only we knew, you know, what the outcome would be if we got COVID. I know there's antivirals and all that lot, but then you read so many, I've read so many messages on Facebook of people not getting it within the right time and things like that. I mean, some antivirals at home would be great. I know it'd be more expense for the NHS, but that would be something. Oh, I've got COVID, right, okay, I start taking these now without having to wait.
Well, what my oncologist has said is that if I test positive for COVID, she said, do let the unit know, because they triage and decide whether that you have the antivirals. But you have to be quite poorly with COVID to warrant having the antivirals, because actually the antivirals can make you feel more poorly than actually the COVID itself.
Oh, right.
So if you have any mild COVID, which could be just like a bad head cold, you're better off to stick with that and build up your own antibodies in some respect. But it's the not knowing, how bad is it going to get? Am I going to be leaving it too long before I then get the antivirals?
Yeah.
It's just really very difficult for people like us, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, being on this PARP inhibitor now, I am immunosuppressed. That's why I'm able to get these COVID injections so often. Yeah. And I've got a daughter who just carries on with life, and she's very sociable. And I mean, very, very sociable. And I've been very aware of not going in her house. Only meeting her out. Luckily, she lives on a farm, so we'll go for a walk, and I'll keep my distance away. You know, and it's hard like that.
Because you can't ask everybody else to isolate before they see you and do COVID tests and everything else.
Yeah, I'm not at that stage now. I mean, what I tend to do is go with people that I trust that wouldn't come to me with people often.
Yeah.
In the past, it's been me saying, oh, I feel too tired, sorry, I can't come out for a coffee today or whatever. And now it's people, I've got a cold and I'd hate it to be COVID. I have tested negative, but I think we ought to leave it. Yeah. And I respect them for that, although obviously I want to see them, but I think it's important to have those people that you know. So
in all of your story, then, I think what really has come out to me really very obviously is to listen to your intuition. If you think there's something wrong, then really be your own advocate and push for things to be done.
Yeah.
I think is one of the greatest messages that has come out of your conversation with me today. Tell me if is there anything else that you think?
I would agree. We know our own bodies, really. If we feel unwell, we should ask GPs for tests. If they won't give them us, we should ask why and say, right, like this written in our medical notes. I've said that before. With hindsight, I had never thought of private testing. I'd never involved anything. Mm-hmm. It had always been the NHS that I could trust. And I didn't look into the fact that I could get genetic testing if I wanted to. And if I'd have done that, I probably then would have come across the link with ovarian cancer, which I hadn't got. Mm. You know, I was lucky. I'd never been ill until I was 66, not needed it. Mm. And if you can't get it, the genetic test through the NHS and can afford a private test, I think it's about £300, do it.
Yeah.
I spent too many years worrying about the fact that I may have a faulty gene. And advocate for yourself, ask questions, do research into trials, etc. yourself. Don't think you're making a fuss. It's your life, and mm-hmm. knowledge is power. Yeah. Use also any of the ovarian cancer charities. I found Overcome extremely good. Yeah. I've phoned them up in London several times.
Yeah.
And as I say, advice from lady who've experienced the same symptoms and emotions as you have.
It finds your tribe in a way, isn't it? The peer support, I think, really helps.
I've met some lovely ladies, obviously you included, and gleaned valuable knowledge, which has helped me with the side effects.
Yeah.
And I think there's no point in, you know, particularly somebody like me who lives in the countryside, very rurally. Our doctors say that they only see one ovarian cancer in every 5 years in this area. Strangely enough, I started a group with another lady in Shropshire. Two of the 15 members were ex-pupils of mine. So I don't quite see how that works. But two people that I've taught, also a lot younger than me, joined the group saying, oh, yes. You used to teach me.
Oh. So
I do meet up with ladies in Shropshire. And also I'm a member of a group of Staffordshire with one or two ladies that you know as well. Yeah. And we've met in Nantwich in Cheshire
because where you live, it's sort of on the border there of is it Staffordshire?
Well, we're right to the west. Yeah. Staffordshire's about 35, 40 miles away. Okay. You can be right next to it, yes, if you live in Newport or something like that. But Oswestry is right up in the northwest corner. So, yeah. I like travelling. And pre-COVID, yes, I did an awful lot of travelling. But
I think that finding support is very, very important because that. You, at first you do feel a little bit out on a limb and how am I going to get through this, but once you find people that have also been through similar things to you, have similar symptoms and all that sort of thing, it really is such a relief and a reassurance, isn't it, to find people that truly understand what you're talking about.
I've always, being a teacher, and I've always liked helping people. And as I say, on these sites, I'm very happy to give my non-medical advice, you know, about side effects and things like that.
We're very similar.
That they're not making a fuss. Just go to A&E. You know, so many ladies get diagnosed at A&E. Please do it. Don't. You know, this is all with hindsight.
Yeah. I think we're so similar in many respects, because encouraging people to be their own advocate and supporting people.
Yeah.
And it's making sure that we accept the support ourselves and don't think, oh, we can do this on our own, you know, because we take it upon ourselves to look at what's out there, look at what we need to do, be our own advocate, try to control everything, when actually cancer can't control the timeline of cancer, no matter how hard you try.
Yeah,
it's just so hard, isn't it? Because things get thrown into the melting pot when you least expect it, and then you've got to cope with something that you weren't expecting. So it is really very difficult.
It's strange, because in a way I was expecting it to have done what I did. You know, people couldn't understand it, that I was, you know, lived and breathed teaching, really. I knew that my husband was very worried about finishing school, because he said, what are you going to do? You know, you're used to having hundreds of people around you. I said, oh, don't worry, I'll find myself. And I found myself. It took me 2 or 3 months to sit down and think of what I would like to do. And I got myself organised to do it. Yeah. There's always something you can get involved.
No, because I did the same. I retired. I took ill health retirement, and people were saying, well, what are you going to do? But actually, you know, I'm never bored. I can always find something to do.
Yeah,
there is so much to do. So,
that's right.
Yeah.
If you live in the countryside with a garden and you know, we grow vegetables and
You mentioned your husband being worried about you in respect of retiring, but how does your husband cope with all of this? Because we need to think about our loved ones, don't we, that are sharing this.
I think they do. Well, people say that your loved ones, it's very hard, much harder for them than for the actual person. But funnily enough, well, I suppose because I'm such a talkative person, my husband is really quite quiet and keeps a lot of what he feels to himself. Aww. So he's very good. He'll get me cups of tea and things like that, anything you ask for him to do, but he'll do it. But the one thing he does do, he works a lot outside the house. And I think that is his way of coping with it. Like today, you know, he's gone off at 10 o'clock and he said, I'll be back at sort of 5 o'clock. Mm. And he's renovating a flat by himself, doing absolutely everything.
He keeps busy then.
Yeah, he does. He's a busy person.
Yeah. Do you think that if he needed support, do you think that he'd access support from somewhere?
I don't know. I don't think so. Mm. No, I think he's of the nature that he will help anybody, but he doesn't. He's very independent.
Yeah.
And for example, when new neighbours come round here, I say, oh, my husband's got so many tools. If you need to borrow them, just come and knock at the front door. So we do that. And he doesn't mind at all, but he would never say that himself. He's very independent and very willing to help anybody else.
I think it's hard for men because they are quite notorious for not wanting to share their feelings, and they hold it inside, and then it manifests in other things like an illness or something.
He's not.
There is support for men out there.
All
of the ovarian cancer charity advice lines, they are more than happy to help them, as are Macmillan as well. So that's their first port of call, or obviously their GP for some counselling. But that's the thing with counselling, though, is that you wait now so long these days because mental health services really have nosedived, haven't they, since COVID?
Yeah.
I mean, it was very difficult to access counselling even before COVID, but now it's all nigh on impossible. But the ovarian cancer charities are more than willing to help.
I think it's wonderful when I see men writing for women on the ovarian cancer site. You know,
oh, I do too.
Wanting advice and whatever like that. It's really, really.
The fact that they're
mine would never do that. Never ever do it.
no, mine wouldn't either. He tends to think, well, because I was a nurse specialist, and he leaves it for me to tell him about everything, you know. And I think that he just he just trusts that I'll tell him things in a timely manner.
Yeah.
And he doesn't actually need to do anything, but it does get quite hard for him to sometimes. Yeah. Seeing that steady sort of decline, if you like, that happens with ovarian cancer.
Right.
But I'm in a different situation to you, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. I'm so grateful to you for telling your story so eloquently.
Oh, it's some help to somebody, that's,
You will. Yeah. You will be surprised how many people will listen to your episode. Great. And how much it will mean to them and help them.
Brilliant. So. Okay.
We're going to end on those fun questions. So what song would be your signature tune for your life, do you think, Jo?
Oh, I Will Survive. That came straight away to my head.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. And I can imagine you singing it too.
Yes, oh, I do, and dance.
Yeah. Oh, what do you want to be remembered for?
Being helpful, being able to listen, believe it or not, being cheerful, enjoying life. I've got a zest for life. We've just recently put a zip wire in between two trees on the hill outside of
Oh, Jo. Oh.
At the age of 71, 100 feet it is, 35 metres.
Oh, you must send a video. You must send a video.
All the children have got videos. I can send you a video. Yes.
Oh, I'd love that.
I do silly things. You know, I done a bit of, it's not skydiving, it's air kicks where you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to do things like that and parasailing and parasending and. Hot air ballooning.
Good for you. You've just so much fun, aren't you? You're just so, I think you have got that zest for life, and you've achieved what you want to be remembered for. You're such a good friend. You really are.
Well, I hope so. I've got several good friends that I can rely on really well, that I've known for a long time. In fact, my best friend from primary and secondary school 62 years ago moved just outside Oswald Street during COVID, her and her husband. So
Brilliant.
Listen, I've known one or two others even longer than that, but it's great to have friends that will help, especially when I've got no brothers or sisters. And I've got to say, please don't put this on the tape, but
it's recording, so if you don't want it on tape, tell me afterwards.
Okay.
Now everybody will be trying to guess what you were going to say, and I'm going to keep it secret. So moving on then, what was the last book you read, or is there a book that you'd recommend to everyone?
Oh gosh,
you get tired.
I've read lots of books about cancer recently. And I can't say I'd recommend really any of it. I can say that I find this Starve Cancer by Jane McClelland, I find that really, really hard to understand. I bought that and, I've got a mind. I can't even remember.
Don't worry. No, you sound to me like you are so busy that reading, you know, is the last thing that you're going to do.
It isn't a priority, but I do read an occasional book, but it's probably 6-8 weeks ago. And
well, if you're anything like me, Jo, I pick books up and I think this is good, and then I put it down, don't pick it up for ages, and I can't remember what I've read. So I've got books that are half read all over the place, really.
Yeah. But I love this, I love Brian Bilston poetry.
Yeah.
That appeals to my sense of humour.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely.
He's got a book out, actually. I'm going to get that if and when I go to it in October. It'll be my first time that I've been with people.
I hope you do, because you'll be the one in the crowd that's absolutely laughing your head off.
I will. Yes, if my husband comes with me, he'll be going, shh.
Life's too short not to laugh, Taylor.
Absolutely, you've got to enjoy yourself. And if you laugh out loud, well,
oh, bless
that's
you.
Great. It does your immune system a lot of good.
It does. Yeah, there is research.
This is what I found actually with the Ukrainian couple, having them here. We got on extremely well right from the start. The man was very fluent in English. And within half an hour, we were laughing and joking and had the same type of humour. And his wife, her English was okay. But I just said to him, you need to go back to your football coaching in Qatar, and Marina's English will improve tremendously because you're putting her off. Like, this is bad. Yeah. And he went back and she stayed on here. And every day for 2 or 3 hours, we just talked and laughed. She kept saying, you're doing so much for me. And I say, but you'll never know how much you're doing for me either. It was a very, very, both of us were helping each other. It was great. So yeah, it was really sad when they left.
Yeah, you did such an amazing thing there, Jo.
She Zooms quite often because she doesn't like a life in Doha. Oh. It's 50 degrees and with the young baby, they go out at 7 o'clock only at night time because it's too hot. They've not got a car.
Oh.
And yeah, baby goes to sleep at about 11 or 12 midnight. Mm-hmm. And they've got the curtains closed and blinds because it's so hot, and they're living in air conditioning. And
it's not the same as where you are, is it?
No, the opposite. Very good. We did heat here. April and May was dreadful, sitting out in the garden all the time with blankets, not water bottles. Anyway.
Well, the last question I've got for you.
Oh, right, sorry.
Where in the world would you say is a must to visit in a lifetime?
Well, I've been very, very lucky. I would love to go back to the Cook Islands, South Pacific, for our silver wedding. 23 years ago, we had a lovely holiday in the Pacific. And I just absolutely loved Rarotonga. Not Fiji or Tahiti, they're too commercialised.
Yeah.
And we met some lovely, lovely people there who they didn't hassle the tourists or anything like that, but they sat and told you about their life story and come and have a look at their house and things like that. That's the kind of thing. I like to know how people live.
Yeah, different cultures. It's so,
and not to be seen as the typical tourist wherever I go. But yes, it's absolutely beautiful. The lifestyle. I did say, actually, when I finished school, retired from school, that I thought that I might do some volunteering out there. And I was hoping that my husband would come with me. But I'm afraid he's too rooted in Shropshire. And with coming from Norway, he's got no interest in going back to Norway. Or, you know, I said I'd need to go for a year, and I don't want to really be away from you for a year. And he said, no, I don't want to go for a year. So I would love to have gone and volunteered out there. It's a really lovely life.
Yeah. Well, you're finding other things to do instead. So,
I'm sure I will.
Yeah.
Always got things planned.
I have loved talking to you. I really have. You're such an interesting lady, and you've got so many, so many wise words. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for listening. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening today. To hear future episodes of this podcast, please go ahead and subscribe now. I look forward to sharing more inspiring conversations with women who are living with ovarian cancer. Until next time, take care of yourselves and each other, and enjoy all that life has to offer.